Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The Democratic presidential field is ever expanding, with the entrance late last week of former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke, and this weekend the announcement of New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. With so many candidates, New Hampshire voters are hearing a wide array of views on issues from income inequality to climate change to the Republican critique that the Democratic Party is becoming socialist. Today in The Exchange, tough issues and a full house for the Democrats. Let's hear from you. What have you heard from these candidates? What do you want to hear? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With us for the hour, Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. And Ron, it's really great to have you. Welcome back to The Exchange.
Great to be with you, Laura.
Well, let's talk first, Ron, about the size of this field. And I definitely want to get into all the issues with you because there's a ton. But I do have to start with that, because in all your years of covering politics, Ron, have you ever seen a field as big as this one?
No, certainly not in the Democratic Party. We had a really large field in the Republican Party back in 2016. But among Democrats, this is unusual, and it's a record setter. It does remind me of some of the big fields we have seen in the past, but they weren't half as big as this.
So what are we up to now? Last count I saw, 17, Ron? I don't want to pin you down because somebody could be jumping in as we speak.
Well, Joe Biden got one foot in over the weekend by referring to himself among the people who were running for president and then quickly saying, or thinking about running. And of course, the audience laughed and people shouted, "Run, Joe, run," and so forth. But he had made some reference to his own record being as good as that of any of the people running. And it just came across grammatically and syntactically as a sort of half announcement. I think most everyone expects that Joe Biden will run. Other than that, I guess we're officially at 15. If we throw in Joe Biden, throw in the governor of Montana, Steve Bullock, maybe another congressman from California, that could get us up to 20 if you're counting a couple of Republicans. That would be the president, who's clearly running for re-election, and also former Massachusetts governor and a familiar figure in New Hampshire, William Weld.
Right, who came to New Hampshire about a month or so ago, announced he was sort of exploring, but nothing since. Since you mentioned the Biden factor, Ron, let's hear a little bit from Joe Biden. Here he is speaking recently at a firefighters event in D.C., calling for Americans to come together and noting that he himself has been criticized for, as he put it, saying nice things about Republicans.
Folks, this is not who we are. That's not how we got here. We have to remember what it is that makes this nation so special. It's our core values. It's what we believe. It sounds corny, but it's the American creed. I mean, for real.
Again, that's Joe Biden speaking recently in D.C. And Ron, when you have a field this big, and as you said, right now 15, could be 20, what kind of political dynamics occur when you have just this many people?
A lot of personality dynamics occur. People try to contrast themselves in terms of their style. So, for example, you have Bernie Sanders, who is well known in New England and well known all around the country for his 2016 run. And he is trying to change a little bit of his personality dynamics. If you heard him on our NPR Morning Edition this morning, he didn't sound very much like the old Bernie, the big rally Bernie anyway. He sounded much more subdued. Now, he often sounded that way in radio interviews even back in 2015 and 2016, but that's not the guy people remember. They remember the guy up in front of the 10,000, 20,000 person rallies that really put him on the map back in 2015 and 2016. Even Donald Trump was complimenting Bernie Sanders on the size and enthusiasm of those rallies. Now then, you've also got a lot of people trying to differentiate themselves by reason of their style. Beto O'Rourke, a little bit like Joe Biden, saying, let's not say bad things about each other. Let's try to, put our best foot forward as personalities and seem like nice folks. Amy Klobuchar might have been there before either of those two people. She's a senator from Minnesota, and she has tried to say that she's all about the Midwest and the Midwest's style of doing politics, which is perhaps seen as a little less bare-knuckled, although that may be myth as much as reality. So you've got that kind of differentiation, and then, of course, you've got people taking somewhat different views, although not radically different views, on the issues.
Well, and since you talked about, again, with this many people, right, there will be differences on the issues, a little bit on health care or the Green New Deal and so forth. But I'm seeing what you're talking about, Ron, people sort of establishing their style and voters kind of keying into that. Let's hear a little bit from Bernie Sanders. Here he is speaking in Keene recently, listing the positions he said were once derided as radical and taking credit for making these, he said, mainstream.
Guaranteeing health care to all people as a right, too radical. Creating up to 15 million jobs by investing $1 trillion to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure, too radical. Aggressively combating climate change, too radical.
Again, that's Bernie Sanders speaking in Keene recently. A little more of the old Bernie Sanders that we saw from 2016, Ron. This gets to a point, though, that the Republicans have been making about this Democratic field. When Cory Booker announced his candidacy, the RNC, the Republican National Committee, put out this statement. I want to share just a little bit with you, Ron, and get your thoughts. The Republican National Committee said, the Democratic primary field is moving increasingly to the left as 2020 contenders continue to flirt with socialism. Socialist policies, whether it be government-run health care, taxpayer-funded jobs, or a government takeover of education and climate, are part of the platforms of nearly all of the presidential contenders, including Cory Booker. And the RNC puts out statements like this, whenever someone jumps in. But what about this charge that we're hearing a lot these days of socialism, Ron?
The Republicans have been accusing the Democrats of being a socialist party since 1935, when the Democratic Congress under President Franklin Roosevelt invented Social Security. That's a program that could be called a form of socialism and certainly had the word social in it, but which over the years has turned out to be pretty much the most popular thing the federal government has ever done in terms of social policy. The accusation of socialism came back in 1965 when the Democrats under Lyndon Johnson created Medicare and Medicaid and a number of other programs known as the Great Society. That too was called socialism, and much of that, certainly Medicare, is now untouchable in American politics. And of course, we heard about Democrats being socialist every time they proposed either higher taxes on the wealthy or some other kind of a social program. The difference in 2020 is that now the Democrats themselves, some of them, are embracing the term. Bernie Sanders, not really a Democrat, but an independent running for the Democratic nomination, has been embracing this term throughout his career, back to his days as mayor of Burlington over in Vermont. He has been embracing this term all the way back to his days as a student at the University of Chicago when he was a civil rights activist in the early 1960s. So he doesn't have a problem with it, but that was part of the reason that the other Democrats didn't want him to be calling himself a Democrat, or even for that matter, at some points, associating himself with the Democratic Party, because they were still afraid of that word socialism. The newest generation of Democrats now coming to Congress, and we have to mention her name because she is the symbol of the freshman class, AOC, right? We all know about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She embraces the term socialist. Now, of course, she, like Bernie, wants to say Democratic socialist. as opposed to the kinds of socialists that are associated with dictatorships in the past, or for that matter, with the Maduro regime in Venezuela. They don't want to be that kind of socialist. They want to be people who get elected to do things that then might be described as socialistic programs, but only at the behest and the will of the actual voters.
So, and as our listeners know, you know, Bernie Sanders, long, as you said, associated with socialist causes and having that label attached to his name in Vermont. But how about the other candidates, Ron? How do you hear other Democratic presidential candidates sort of sorting through this?
They're going to push that term away, particularly the ones who are currently serving in office. They're going to say, well, I've never been comfortable with that particular word for whatever reason. If you are of Joe Biden's generation, of course, you remember that socialism was part of the program of the Communist Party. I want to be sure that people understand that there are real differences between communism, central state planning, one-party government, and socialism. But the two were associated generationally back through much of the 20th century. And many of us grew up with that, grew up with the Red Scares, grew up with people being desperately afraid of anything that smacked of the Soviet Union, for example, USSR. One of the words in USSR was socialist. So that was just scary to people. And so older Democrats in particular are going to try to push that term away and say, let's call it something else. Let's call it a social program like Social Security. And let's leave the isms to somebody else.
What about younger Democrats? And in asking me that, Ron, I'm talking about younger Democratic voters. How do they view the term socialist, given that they did not grow up with the specter of, you know, nuclear war with the USSR? I remember one analyst in 2016 said, you know, younger voters associate socialism with drinking coffee in Sweden.
and indeed, the Swedes have had their own form of socialism for quite a long time, along with a lot of other countries in Europe that would be shocked to be confused with the Soviet Union. But let's just talk about the definition in the minds of younger voters, millennials and Gen Z people. They come along and they say, hey, we'll define the term for ourselves. Thank you very much. We have associations with the word social. And for that generation, perhaps the strongest of those associations is social media. And social media largely define the political attitudes and the political information of younger people. And when I say younger people, I'm talking about the millennial generation and people who are younger. The students of today in college are largely, new ones, are Generation Z. And their politics are a lot like the millennials. So they, generally speaking, communicate with each other and, generally speaking, get their information from social media. And so for them, this word has a whole different set of associations, and they don't have the bad memories of the 20th century, thank God. And so they can step up to defining the term for themselves.
One last question about this, because, again, Republicans have made a big, big deal about this term, and I am very curious as to how voters, Democratic voters, and general election voters will interpret it. So you're saying, Ron, in the Democratic field and in the Democratic primary, it may not have the heft that Republicans hope. But in a general election, very different from a primary, obviously, will this socialist label be a problem?
It will be with some voters. Older voters who already are the people most likely to vote Republican, people over, say, 55, 60, 65, except when they get worried about Social Security and Medicare. But generally speaking, people in that age category are the most likely to vote Republican, and they are the most likely to have the negative associations with the term. To some degree, it's ironic that the oldest candidate in the field, Bernie, is 77. He'd be 79 on Inauguration Day. He is the one who is freest in using the term. But generally speaking, the people who would be most disturbed by it are the people more in his age cohort, and they do vote. They do vote. The tendency to vote goes up with age. It goes up with some other categories, too. But the really clearest indicator that people are more likely to vote has historically been age. Just a little bit more maturity gets people more involved in the culture and in the society and the politics, and they vote. So that is going to be a problem for Democrats in some parts of the country, particularly, say, for example, the rural areas of swing states like North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Iowa, even Ohio, which may or may not be a swing state anymore. In those kinds of areas where the Democrats were weak in 2016, that where folks didn't like Hillary Clinton too much, their problem could shift from being the candidate to being some of the candidate's language. But we're just going to have to see how that plays out.
Let's go to our listeners, Ron. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. How do you feel about this socialist label that Republicans have put on these Democratic candidates? How do you want to hear the Democratic candidates talk about it? And if you've gone to some of these Democratic events in the state recently or just seen a Democratic candidate while you're at the grocery store downtown, let us know what you heard, what you think. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. The number 1-800-892-6477. And Ron, David on Facebook says the big issue for the Democratic Party right now is whether they as a group want to swing to the left to make their base happy or swing to the center and try to govern a deeply divided country. David, thank you so much for that comment. And Ron, I think he's spot on. This is sort of the existential struggle, isn't it?
It is, and it is not brand new, but it may be sharper today than it has been at any point in the recent past. The Democrats do seem to have a clearer choice between candidates who want to do the one and candidates who would rather do the other. Now, what the Democrats would like to do is what the opposition party would always like to do with a relatively unpopular president, and that is make it all about him, make it all about who's in the White House, and put every dissatisfaction, every unhappiness that they possibly can onto the White House lawn. And in this particular case, we have a president who insists on making the daily discussion, the daily discourse on every subject in every part of the United States be all about him. So that helps the Democrats do that shift of focus over to the president. But when the focus comes back, when people question these candidates, as many of them as there are, and particularly in the early states, such as New Hampshire, this is going to be the big question. What do you people want to do? Do you just want to get rid of Donald Trump? Or do you want to reestablish something like the Obama presidency? Or do you want to move further to the left? Do you want something that is more radical in its approach to the problems of the white working class or the people of color in the working class? Who exactly are you running to serve and what are the programs you want to put in place? Some of the candidates are going to take that on, I think, quite head on. And some of the candidates are going to try to duck it right as long as they can.
Well, and getting to the point you're making about how these candidates talk about the president, who obviously they want to replace. During his first visit to New Hampshire in Portsmouth, Cory Booker said it was a mistake for Democrats to focus all their attention on President Trump.
This cannot just be about who can beat the guy in the White House. Is that how we're going to define ourselves? Is that how we're going to limit ourselves?
No.
This has got to be not just about how we're going to beat somebody, but how we're going to unite all of us. This is a crossroads in our history.
Again, that's Cory Booker speaking in Portsmouth. What do you think about that, Ron? It needs to be bigger than just, you know, let's beat Donald Trump. On the other hand, that's kind of the goal of making a nominee.
It is. And at the same time, they're going to look back at what happened to Hillary Clinton in 2016, because one of the things I think most critics have agreed upon, and probably even the internal critics of the Clinton campaign would agree on, is that she did not have enough of a program of her own. What was she planning to do for the working class? What was she planning to do for people other than not be Donald Trump? For a lot of folks, that was enough. But she probably put way too much emphasis on his problems and what she regarded as the unacceptability of his candidacy, and did not say nearly enough about what she was going to do other than be the third term of Barack Obama or the third term of Bill Clinton, either of which seemed pretty probable models for her presidency, and which at the end of 8 years of Democratic rule in Washington, at least in the White House, might not have seemed all that dynamic to a lot of people who hadn't gotten that far ahead since the 2008 recession. And that didn't work for her, and the Democrats don't want to fall into that trap again.
All right. We will talk more after a short break. Keep those comments coming. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. More with NPR's Ron Elving and the ever-expanding field of Democratic presidential candidates. It's all coming up. Keep it right here.
I want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work? Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the Democrats running for president. What they're saying on the campaign trail elsewhere, and especially here in New Hampshire. Send us an email. What have you seen in terms of this large field of Democratic candidates? Who have you seen campaigning in the Granite State? What have you heard them talk about? What would you like to hear them talk about? Again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is great, NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Ron Elving is helping us out. He's senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. He joins us from D.C. And Ron, right back to our listeners, where Paul is calling in from White River Junction. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura and Ron. Quick question. We know that whoever the Democratic candidate is going to be severely attacked on both political and personal issues by Mr. Trump. Do you think Joe Biden will be capable and able to respond to any attacks that Trump makes and respond well and strongly? I'll take my answer while listening to the radio. Thank you very much.
Paul, thank you for calling in. Go ahead, Ron.
One thing you can say for Joe Biden is he has been around the track before. He has had the opportunity to absorb a few blows. Back in 1987, when he was running for president, some things came out about material he had lifted from other politicians' speeches to use in his own. That hurt him very badly, and he had a bit of a meltdown right there in New Hampshire talking to a voter. And as a result of those incidents, he dropped out of the race. He was running for the nomination in 1988. He dropped out in the summer of 1987. When he ran for president again in 2008, he ran into some occasions when he used words he probably didn't want to use about Barack Obama, who clearly forgave him and made him his vice president. Joe Biden has had an enormous resiliency in his career, bouncing back from bad incidents that looked like they were going to sink him. And so if you're looking for somebody who can absorb punishment, and obviously the questioner is absolutely right, President Trump is going to dish it out from day one. Even when people like Beto O'Rourke announce and put out a video, the president is all over critiquing the video. So, yes, he's going to have a tremendous amount of skin on his nose. Joe Biden's built up a lot of that skin. So I think maybe some of the other Democratic candidates are going to have a little more trouble with Trump than Biden.
Well, let's talk about the age factor. Since we're talking about Joe Biden, since we've already talked about Bernie Sanders, correct me if I'm wrong, Ron, I think Joe Biden is 76, Bernie Sanders is 77. Getting up there, especially to take on, you know, what could be called the most challenging job in the world, how is this being talked about in this Democratic field? Are the other candidates kind of staying away from the age factor?
Just a little bit. I think the other candidates would rather be judged on something rather than their youth, strictly. And we have had presidents in the past who have served into their 70s. Of course, that raises other issues. Ronald Reagan was quite popular, was reelected by 49 states. But I don't think there's any question that during his second term, he was beginning to show some early signs of the Alzheimer's. That would eventually be the end of his life. So we have to talk about the age issue because it just is an issue. It automatically is. And you mentioned Bernie Sanders' age. And yes, Joe Biden is, in fact, 76. Bernie would be 79 on the day he was inaugurated president in 2021.
79 on inauguration day.
And here's the other number to bear in mind. He would be 87 at the end of that term. And it's one thing to talk about a 77-year-old president. It's another thing to talk about an 87-year-old president. And in our time, I think it's safe to say, the presidency has come to be regarded as an 8-year contract. If a party is going to give you its nomination and put you in the White House, it wants you to be re-elected, because presidents are much more likely to be re-elected than candidates are likely to be elected president. So they want an 8-year president, and you are signing on to do a job in 2 years. you are 87 years old, and it is a 24/7, 12-month-a-year job.
Well, I asked our listeners earlier how they felt about this socialist label, how they saw it being used so far in this presidential primary, and we got an email from Brian who says, socialism, like any other label, is just a word we humans use to lump people into groups so we can deal with them as a, quote, them, instead of getting into complicated details. Politicians shamelessly use these labels to manipulate their voters by inciting emotion over reason. Brian says these are old, tired, but effective pejorative smear tactic politics. I just wish it wasn't so darn effective. Brian, thank you for that email. I'd like to hear from listeners how they view this age issue. And we'll also start to get into the issues that are being talked about in this field, Ron, of gender, of race. So again, you can join us like Brian did. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Or Paul gave us a call. You can call 1-800-892-6477. So on the age issue, Ron, and how the other candidates are talking about this, I want to play a little bit from someone who's on the other end of the age spectrum, Pete Buttigieg. He's mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He's a millennial. He spoke at St. Anselm College here in New Hampshire recently, highlighting his age, just 37, excuse me, and he said younger leadership is needed.
I was in high school when the Columbine shooting happened. I literally belong to the school shooting generation. And I understand what is in the eyes of young people who are calling an older generation to account for our failure to keep them safe. I belong to the generation that will be dealing for the rest of our lives with the implications of climate change. That is a personal issue for us, not a theoretical one. And so too is the economic question of whether we are on track to be the first generation in American history to earn less than our parents if nothing is done to change the trajectory of this economy. And by the way, not for lack of contributing, because we are also the generation that provided most of the troops, including me, for the conflicts after 9/11.
So that's Pete Buttigieg again, mayor of South Bend, Indiana, speaking here in New Hampshire. You know, people had not heard of him before, Ron, but a couple of people who I know who saw him speak said he was pretty impressive. What do you think?
Indeed. I actually am very highly impressed with Pete Buttigieg. He is the sort of person who in another era would probably have a very good shot at statewide office in his home state and perhaps a very good shot at eventually being a presidential candidate that people were not surprised to hear of, even at his early age and as mayor of South Bend. He is impressing a lot of people. He is also he is an openly gay man. He is married to another man. He has a husband. And not too long ago, any whisper of that would be an utter disqualification for national office. Of course, times have changed, and he can run openly as a married gay man. And I think that that's great from the standpoint of the Republic, and I suspect that in a few more years, that won't even need to be discussed, but we're not necessarily there yet, and certainly not in the state of Indiana, and that may be why he is choosing to step out on the national stage, not as a statewide candidate, but as an articulate spokesperson for a generation, and an articulate spokesperson for veterans, which he is, and this is another part of his persona. So I think he's going to add a lot to the discussion. I don't expect very many people think he'll be on the ticket, at least not in 2020, but perhaps down the road, and perhaps Indiana will also change so that he might have a shot at statewide office in the meantime.
So while we're talking about, you know, Pete Buttigieg bringing diversity into the field as an openly gay married man, let's talk about the broader issue of diversity in this field, specifically race and gender. The Boston Globe had a headline recently, "Is there room for a white guy in the Democratic field?" Women and minorities, Ron, we should say, have dealt with this question forever. Is the country ready to elect a woman or an African-American? What does it say to you about this political moment and this political party that the question, is there room for a white guy, even a question at all?
Well, if you watched the State of the Union address, you saw a visual representation of one of the great things that has happened in our politics in recent years. If you looked over on one side of the House chamber, you saw a group of white men, almost exclusively, 90% of them white men, wearing suits and ties, and well, having a certain amount of uniformity as a bunch of white guys, most of them older, wearing suits and ties, are going to have. And so I probably could have blended right in with that group quite easily. On the other side of the chamber, and actually occupying a somewhat larger portion of the chamber, were a utterly different group of people who looked very much like, well, I mean, some people were saying it looked like a meeting of the United Nations General Assembly. You had people of color, you had people of all ages, you had many, many women. In fact, while there were white males in that group, those white males were slightly less than 40%, 40% on that side of the room. And of course, the two sides were all the Republicans on the first side, all the Democrats on the other side. And so diversity is absolutely the definition of the Democratic Party today. And most of the people who vote Democratic in this country, in every state, are women. They are the majority of the Democratic Party in terms of voters in every state in the union. So that is a definition now for the Democratic Party. It's not just the party of the people. It is, in particular, a party of the people who did not used to produce presumed candidates for statewide office or president. And now you could actually get to the point where the Boston Globe would jokingly ask, is there room for a white guy in the Democratic primary?
Well, and Beto O'Rourke said that if he were the nominee, he would absolutely choose a woman as his vice presidential nominee. We've got some clips also, Ron, of the many female candidates who are running for the Democratic nomination. Let's hear a little bit from Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. She says here, she's speaking in Concord, by the way, in February, and if elected president, she would seek to work with the other side. Let's hear.
I think what we need right now in this country is less of this grandstanding and gridlock, less of the shutdowns, which we just saw, and the put-downs, and much more of moving our country forward. I announced my candidacy in front of the Mississippi River for a reason last weekend. I didn't think it was going to be 17 degrees with a bunch of snow, but it was. And I did that because I wanted to make the point that we need to cross our river of our divides, that we need to walk over this sturdy bridge that is our democracy, and that we need to get to higher ground in our politics.
Again, that's Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. This gets back to something that we talked about earlier, Ron. Some Democrats really saying, if you elect me, I will stand hard and fast with progressive values. And others saying, I will seek to work with the other side. I think it was Hinkenlooper of Colorado who said, I will only pass bipartisan legislation. So he's staking himself in that same field as Amy Klobuchar. What do you think?
John Hickenlooper is the former governor of Colorado, former mayor of Denver, former brew pub operator, former mechanical engineer in a mine. He's done a lot of different things. He's an interesting guy. He doesn't generate the kind of media interest that, say, Beto O'Rourke does, but he is an interesting guy, and he brings a somewhat different approach to all this. You know what we don't know at this point is who's going to catch fire. Who's going to catch fire in New Hampshire? Who's going to catch fire in Iowa? We've seen different candidates catch fire in one state or the other. We have seen people catch fire more or less nationwide, for example, Barack Obama did late in 2007, but not early in 2007. I think it's important to remember that in the early going, with a relatively large field, seven or eight fairly serious candidates in 2007 and 8, Barack Obama did not dominate that field early on. It was Hillary Clinton who did, and he slowly emerged, and mostly in Iowa. He staked his claim and got into the finals of the 2008 presidential primaries and eventually wound up with the nomination. But he did not catch fire overnight by any means. He had given one great speech back in 2004, and he then built it up and built it up and built it up one town at a time. So we don't have any idea if there's a Barack Obama in this field. There may just not be. Or there may be someone that the party demands become, in some sense or another, the breakout Obama-type candidate in 2020.
Yeah, I saw a little bit of that this weekend. People saying, who's the Barack Obama in this field? Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, that's something the party would desperately like to have. And I suspect that's part of the reason that there's so much fascination with Beto O'Rourke, is that he seems to have a personal charisma, even though he does not have much of a political resume, a few terms, three terms in the House of Representatives, one great campaign against Ted Cruz that ultimately came up short in Texas. And, you know, he has a generational appeal and a lot of other kinds of appeal, but people don't really know much about him. And he's going to find out very quickly now whether or not he can take a punch.
Well, and Barack Obama didn't have very much political experience either. He had local experience, but, you know, a fair amount of time in the Illinois legislature, but just half a term, right, in the U.S. Senate. So, you know, Better or Worse experience at least matches up with Barack Obama's.
And in a sense, it does, although he had not won a statewide race and was probably not likely to win one. And Obama also had one other special characteristic, and that was that he was making people actually be able to believe that an African-American could be elected president of the United States, that there could be a black president. That narrative, as much as anything else about him, really caught on. And while it was seen initially as a burden to run as a black man, and it always had been seen, certainly in Jesse Jackson's day, it was seen as a burden to try to run as a non-white candidate. Huh. But it turned out to be, if you will, the jet fuel for Barack Obama, because he managed to make that somehow inspirational, even to people who had never really been part of any sort of movement and people who had never imagined themselves voting for a black person, voted for him sometimes twice, and actually, to the shock of many political observers, turned around in 2016 and voted for Donald Trump. We're still trying to get our heads around that one.
Let's take another call, Ron. This is Jim in Swansea. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me.
Yep.
My question is, when are we going to start talking about getting us out of the Middle East? We've been there for some areas 18 years and haven't done anything that hasn't been counterproductive significance. And in the time we talked about that, too, the only one, as far as I can see, that is talking about it is Tulsi Gabbard.
Yeah, Jim, thank you for the call, both for mentioning Tulsi Gabbard and also mentioning this issue of getting out of the Middle East. I think Senator Sanders, actually, on NPR, talked about that this morning as well, Ron. So go ahead, chime in on the issue, Ron, and also remind us who Tulsi Gabbard is. That's another name.
That is another name. She also is 37. She's a congresswoman from Hawaii. And she is the kind of person who, while she does represent a very Democratic state, a very blue state, talks a lot about talking to both sides and is someone who reaches out on a generational basis. And as several of the candidates this time around on the Democratic side, we have quite a few women who are considered very serious candidates, including Elizabeth Warren, including, as we've talked about, Amy Klobuchar, Kirsten Gillibrand just declared over the weekend. And Tulsi Gabbard is part of both the generational and the woman's dimension in this field. Going to this question of the Middle East, an enormous, difficult, and complex problem, the president has tried on several occasions to make good on his promise to pull us out of all of these countries, all of these military adventures that we've been in particular since 2001. Now, of course, the relationship with Israel is a somewhat separate matter. That goes back to 1948, goes back to World War II. But just in terms of the post-9/11 commitments that we've made in Afghanistan, then the ill-fated Iraq War, then our in-and-out relationship with the Syrian Civil War, all of these great sorrows that we have been involved in, and as the caller suggests, in some cases have clearly made worse, as we did in Iraq, all of those situations, the president has found it almost impossible to extricate ourselves entirely. He said we were going to pull out of Syria. We were going to pull out of Syria fast. We're still in Syria. We're still having our troops involved in trying to clean up or finish off some of the physical manifestations of ISIS. ISIS, of course, has begun to change itself and reappear around the world. It's not eradicated, but at least the territory that they held. So until that is over, we probably won't get entirely out of Syria. And if you look at back over the experience of the last couple of decades, we might not get entirely out of the Middle East for many years yet to come.
Well, I'm glad you raised it, Jim, because it is an important issue. And also Arnie in Canterbury sent us an email saying, will the candidates call for reduced spending on war, nuclear weapons, to redirect tax funds to programs addressing poverty and climate? So there is an interest in these international issues, even though right now the candidates don't seem to be talking about them that much. We will tackle a lot more of your questions and comments after a short break, and we'll play some more clips from some of these candidates as they've been campaigning around the Granite State. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Keep NHPR in the loop. If you're a sustainer and you've received a new credit card, take a moment to update your payment information. Better yet, switch your sustainer payments to your checking account so you never have to update expired or replaced cards again. Giving as a sustainer for just $10 or $15 a month is the easiest and most powerful way to support the station that keeps New Hampshire connected. Update your information easily at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, Granite State reaction to the college admissions scandal unveiled last week. Join us tomorrow morning, live at 9, for that. This hour, we're looking at the very large, and possibly still to get larger, field of Democratic presidential candidates who have been all over New Hampshire, including just this past weekend. Send us an email with your thoughts, questions, comments about some of the themes that you hear these candidates talking about and what you would like to hear them talk about. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can always send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Ron Elving is joining us. He's senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. And Ron, back to our listeners' comments. And we got an email from Paul who says, the Democratic candidates are not all in agreement on the issues, yet you are glossing over their differences. You have repeated the term socialism over and over with regard to the Democratic candidates, and so you are tacitly endorsing the Republicans' spin to label all Democrats as socialists. Why don't you, Paul asks, talk about the actual accomplishments of the individual Democrats? Paul, I just want to say it is absolutely not our intention to endorse a charge by Republicans, but to look at how these Democratic candidates are responding to the charge. Also, Ron gave us some of the history of how voters feel about this charge. So I'm sorry that if it came across that way to you. But Ron, I think I was trying to present, and clearly not well enough for Paul, that this charge is going to be made. Republicans are already making it every single time somebody announces on the Democratic side. So my intention was to ask you how you thought Democrats would respond to this. So I don't know if you want to add anything else there to Paul.
Only that Paul reflects how a great number of people feel, I think, among Democrats or more broadly on the left, that the term socialism is misused and it's used as a weapon by Republicans, including the president. And it will be used by Republican spinmeisters or whatever you want to call them, people who do opposition research to try to besmirch candidates. And the problem for Democrats who are experienced at pushing this term away because it is used that way rather than in its actual meanings, the problem for those Democrats is that in the new generation of Democrats and also in among independent, socialistic-minded people such as Bernie Sanders, who is now running for the Democratic nomination, this is one of the reasons people had a problem with him doing that back in 2016, it is a term that is embraced. And so that makes it more difficult, and it makes the dance more difficult for all the other candidates. And I would like to talk about the individual accomplishments and views and achievements of all the Democratic candidates, but it's a problem when you have 15 of them.
Yeah.
And that's just the official ones and doesn't include several others we expect will be a major part of the race.
You know, it's interesting, as I was preparing to talk with you, Ron, last week, and then this morning I thought maybe Ron and I just this week should talk about the candidates whose names begin with B. And then, you know, next week we can talk about the candidates whose names begin with C, because, you know, our listener is right. It is hard to talk about their individual accomplishments when there are so many. I do want to let you know, Paul, and everybody know, that we will start interviewing the candidates here in The Exchange. The team on Morning Edition has already started interviewing them, so that will give us a chance to dive into some of their accomplishments. In fact, next Thursday, we have Congressman Delaney from Maryland on our show. He is actually, we should talk about him a little bit, Ron. He's one of the first people to announce that he was running for president, but hasn't yet gotten that much attention.
This is someone who I believe really inaugurated the race. He was the first person to get out there and start campaigning pretty much full time. He's a former congressman from Maryland. He is 55 years old. He is certainly not a household name, not even in Maryland. But he felt that if he got out there to Iowa and New Hampshire early enough, and he's really been focusing on Iowa, that he could do what Jimmy Carter did way back in the 1970s, go from almost total obscurity, although he had been a governor, and go all the way from that to the White House via Iowa, largely by going to the early states and making a name for himself and becoming a popular figure there, winning in defiance of all expectations by the national media, and suddenly becoming an overnight phenomenon I suspect he may also have a number of things that he would like to accomplish in terms of moving the debate in certain directions. But that's why John Delaney, I think, got in so early. And thus far, he does not seem to have made much of a dent in Iowa, and certainly not outside of it. But this is really the point where this all begins. We're really just now beginning to feel the force field pulling us in, so that we start to think in terms of 2020 more than in terms of 2018 or 2016. And as that happens, let's not count out John Delaney.
All right. And again, we'll be talking to him on The Exchange next Thursday. So listeners, you can join us for that. And also, of course, send your comments in advance. It's exchange@nhpr.org. So got an email here from Steve in Nashua, who says, please provide more details regarding female candidates. That's something else we should talk about. So thank you so much, Steve. There are, correct me if I'm wrong, an unprecedented number of women in this field, Ron, right?
Yes, we have five women among the official candidates and others who may still think about running. But that, of course, includes some of the people that we have talked about, Tulsi Gabbard, Kirsten Gillibrand from this weekend, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren. I think we've mentioned all those names. These people are the ones that folks have heard of. There's also Marianne Williamson, who is a person who had been an AIDS activist in the past and has also written a number of books of spiritual and self-help nature. And she's out there in New Hampshire making a lot of appearances. I see her showing up in Nashua. I see her showing up in other parts around the state. And she is going to be, I think, in some degree, a factor, and she may get into some of the early Democratic debates. So that's another a woman in the race. As I said earlier, most of the people who vote Democratic in America are women, and it's about time that we had a candidate, we had a field of candidates where there was real competition among women. And we also have the first field I can remember in which we have real competition among people of color. Not only Kamala Harris, whom I hope we've mentioned here, but I'm afraid we might have not mentioned up until now because we have all these senators and all
right.
these women. But we have Kamala Harris, the outspoken woman senator from California, getting a lot of attention, making it into the short list of 3, 4, 5 candidates for a lot of people. And so we should definitely mention Kamala Harris. We should also mention among the people of color also Julian Castro, who was the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the Obama administration. Before that, he was also in politics. And his brother Joaquin Castro is a congressman and possibly running for the Senate in that state. So the Castro brothers are also a part of Democratic politics and have been mentioned as future candidates on national tickets. And Julian is running this time for president. I think we've mentioned Cory Booker. So there is a real competition among people of color in the Democratic field this time, as there is a real competition among multiple women candidates for the first time in my experience.
Well, Steve, I really appreciate the email. And Ron, since we're talking about the many women candidates in this field, let's hear a little bit from them. First, I want to play a little bit from Kamala Harris. Here she is speaking recently to the online magazine The Root. Kamala Harris was asked how she feels about the idea of reparations to African Americans. And she started off this conversation by saying, I support some form of reparations, and we can talk about what that is. Let's hear.
We're looking at more than 200 years of slavery. We're looking at almost 100 years of Jim Crow. We're looking at legalized segregation and in fact, segregation on so many levels that exist today based on race. And there has not been any kind of intervention done, understanding the harm and the damage that occurred, to correct course.
Again, that's Kamala Harris. And you mentioned earlier, Ron, but I would like to ask you a little bit more. You said Kamala Harris has, you know, so far, and it's very early, has been vaulted to by I don't know, the cognoscenti, the powers that be, to that top tier of candidates.
That's right. And part of that is based on the fact that the Democrats are going to have a diverse ticket. It's just almost unimaginable that the Democrats would have two white males on their ticket in 2020. The last time that happened was 2004, John Kerry, John Edwards. I just can't imagine the Democrats, given all the things we've said about their demographics, would not have at least one woman and at least one person of color on this ticket, or at least one or the other. So Kamala Harris would provide a winner there in terms of both of those internal primaries. And she might very well make a good regional balance as well. And of course, California is by far the largest state in terms of the Electoral College. You get a long way towards the presidency just by winning California. So obviously, that is also a factor. So that's one of the reasons that she perhaps would emerge as a little a bit of a special bonus candidate for the Democrats on the national ticket in 2020 over some of the other women, such as Kirsten Gillibrand from New York or Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota. Not that those aren't big and important states to the Democrats, but California is still California.
All right. Well, and since you mentioned Kirsten Gillibrand, who has been campaigning and talking about a lot of the issues, she spoke on WBUR recently. She's from New York, for listeners who don't know. Here she is talking about a key Democratic issue, and that's climate change and what's called the Green New Deal. Gillibrand says in this cut that the Green New Deal will be bipartisan because, she says, its components already are.
There's only three basic things to the bill. The first is infrastructure, which is already widely bipartisan. People want money for a new electric grid or for mass transit or for rural broadband. They really need it. People want job training for the green jobs. And third, clean air and clean water. It's about making sure we clean up the brownfields, making sure kids aren't being polluted in their drinking water, and taking the time and making the investment to clean it up so we have clean air and clean water as a right. That's what the Green New Deal is about.
Again, that's Kirsten Gillibrand of New York talking about the Green New Deal and some of the themes that she'll be raising as she campaigns for president. Here's another email that came in from Laconia, Ron, from Karen. Karen says, what I need to hear from Democratic candidates is how they will accomplish their goals. Facts, details, specific policies. Karen says, I'm alarmed by the claim by Sanders and others that policies such as Medicare for All, free college, and the Green New Deal are now the mainstream in the Democratic Party, when I'm not so sure those ideas have been adequately explained or sold to the majority of voters nationwide. So this gets into this Democratic, I don't want to call it angst, maybe that's too strong a word, you can correct me, but the concern that by some moderates that the party might be going too far left. Thank you so much for the email, Karen. What do you think, Ron?
That's a thoughtful email. And it's not just because of the back and forth between how far left and how moderate should the Democrats be, but also because all of those ideas that are now being so widely discussed, whether or not they're going to all be in the Democratic platform is another question, but widely discussed to be sure. One of the questions here is, how do you do that? How does that come about? And I want to make sure I mention here Elizabeth Warren, because she is another senator, she is another woman candidate, she is another person who has embraced some of this program, but also wants to step back and say, but look, what we're really trying to do here, and she has been a law professor, and she has been a person who has made consumer finance protection more or less the centerpiece of her early political career, we want to step back here and say, how do we save the system that we have and make it work better for the people it's not working for right now? That's the real focus for Elizabeth Warren and her economics and her politics. Let's try to do better with the system we have now, rather than necessarily talking about socialism or something else that really uproots it. Let's see if we can't make the banks be more responsive to their customers. Let's see if we can't force people to actually own up to the principles of a democratic economy. And that is also something that the Democrats are going to listen to and want to know how it would be implemented and so on. She has the problem, if you will, as a candidate, that she, to some degree, shares a base of voters who have responded to her with with Senator Sanders. And that, you know, I mean, it's tough to run against Bernie on Bernie's issues. So she's trying to redefine them so as to have a lane of her own and also to differentiate herself from some of the other women candidates and from some of the other senators. So we want to make sure we get Elizabeth Warren in there, especially in talking about the six women who are officially running for president.
Wow, it is amazing that six women are officially running for president. Just hearing you say that, Ron, I am struck by that's a big number.
It is indeed. It's approaching half the field of serious candidates that people are paying attention to. It's going to be visible when people start watching these debates that this is a different looking party from the party that had 16 candidates back in 2016.
Well, last couple questions for you, Ron, and there's so much more we could talk about, including, as several of our listeners have raised, you know, focusing on the specifics. With a field this big, you don't have time, but I just want to let listeners know that this is just the beginning, both of conversations with political analysts like Ron, but also conversations with the candidates themselves, where we will, of course, get into specifics. But here's an email that came in before the show, Ron, that I want to share with you from Walter. Please ask Ron Elving what he thinks are the odds of a brokered Democratic convention. Now, you're going to have to remind some people what that is, first of all.
In the old days, you had to have 2/3 of the delegates to be the nominee of the Democratic Party. We won't go into all that history except to say it was tough to get 2/3 of the delegates. If you've been to any or watched any Democratic convention, you know that generally speaking, there is a certain amount of diversity of opinion, even among the people who get to the convention, let alone the people who voted in the primaries and caucuses. So getting to 2/3 was hard. And what had to happen at the convention is that the leading candidate had to make deals with some of the other candidates. We used to call them favorite sons. Now we would more likely call them sons or daughters. But candidates who sprang up from one state and had a few delegates, maybe from their state, maybe from a couple others, and they would make a deal with the leading candidate, maybe get offered vice president or something else, and they would then sign on with the leading candidate. That was what we called a brokered convention, and it took place in those notorious smoke-filled back rooms where people sat around and made deals. I don't think anybody wants to go back to that, but what we may see is a convention where no one candidate arrives with more than 50% of the vote, which is now the threshold for getting the nomination. And if no one has it, if three people are there splitting up the votes, and any one of those three would have a shot at being the nominee, that will be a fun convention to cover and watch.
Wow. I'm just having a hard time imagining that. I mean, it's been so long since we've seen something like that, right, Ron?
It has, basically, we haven't seen anything like that in the television age.
Wow. Okay. Well, there's so much more we could have talked about. Please join us again, Ron. We really appreciate you helping us out, and hope to see you sometime in New Hampshire up here covering the candidates. We've got them for you.
You bet. I'll be there.
Thanks a lot, Ron.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. And remember, our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. We're also on Instagram at NHPR Exchange, so check it out for some fun behind-the-scenes photos and information. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt, Christina Phillips, and Ali Oshinsky. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.